Hey guys, today we are examining a piece from the past that we think has a lot of relevance to the modern scientific landscape. And it digs into an issue that keeps poking its head up in all the conversations that we have on the show with different scientists and thinkers, which is this study being done with a real eye for what the future should look like? And a lot of people balk at the idea that there even ought to be a should in science and in research, other than bigger, better, stronger, faster, and more powerful. And that kind of sketches us out. So what we've done is we pulled a speech from a lecture series that was given at MIT back in 1964, I believe, by Ayn Rand, of all people. And Ayn is essentially chastising the student population for being stripped of their moral compass when it comes to what tasks they're going to devote their talents and scientific energies to. And we just think this couldn't be more relevant than the present moment. So I'm going to read some passages from this, and we're going to try to pin them to the present, because it seems like a discussion that needs to be happening now more than ever.
Definitely. And so this touches on all of the scientific subjects that are geared into technological progress, and the fact that each of us has to make this decision about, you know, how am I going to live my life? What are the things that I'm going to focus on and do for work that are going to be how I spend the next 30 years of my life? And, you know, I think a lot of our audience is older and so has probably already passed through this phase, but there's plenty of people in the audience too that are still searching for what it is they want their life to look like. And I really hope that this conversation about figuring out the moral values that you can use to drive yourself towards a meaningful life is helpful to everybody who listens, even those that are older maybe.
So enjoy the conversation, and if you are enjoying these conversations, especially these solo conversations, let us know in the comments. Maybe we'll keep them going once we get done with this tour. We're headed back west after this. I think this is our farthest point. Oh, no, we're going to Taos, which I guess is a little bit further east.
Tiny bit, yeah.
And we're going to play some music out there, and then we're going to be heading back to California and back up to Oregon.
And as always, if you do like these conversations, consider joining us on Patreon. We have a really, really good crew of Patreon supporters. We get together once a week on Sunday mornings and talk about everything that people have been reading about, the topics that are kind of outside of the exact things we talk about on the podcast, but are the context for everything on the social level, on the scientific level, on the technological level. And it's just a really good group of super curious investigators, and we're really learning how to grow a group that spends its time in conversation from scratch, building friendships, developing these relationships. We have people that have been coming for
since day one.
Hey Steve.
I think it's about you. 2 years in almost.
Yeah. And so it's just been a really fantastic experience. And so if you want to join us, come support us on patreon.com. And if you can't, that's totally fine. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Discord. Leave us a comment, subscribe, and we will see you next time.
Enjoy the conversation.
The scientific revolution starts now.
Let us see in the dark.
So what's on your mind, Shiloh?
Well, one thing we keep coming up against in our study of nature and our study of the study of nature is this idea that the scientist should be a perfectly objective investigator and should serve merely as a tool to inventory nature and catalog the patterns into theories.
Like, we had this really interesting experience the other night when we were watching that documentary about the Rising Star Cave, where they were going into the cave looking at the rites and rituals of the Homo naledi that they found in there. And the head scientist was like, I don't have any kind of spiritual practice. And
that's almost a virtue, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's viewed as like, well, we scientists don't do any of this like weird spirit stuff.
And this sci-fi movie we started last night with my parents.
The Three-Body Problem.
Where one of the chief scientists is asked if they believe in God. And she's like, no, I believe in science. Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I
don't think that's the exact quote. In this house, we believe in science.
Yeah, there it is. And so this is a really, really interesting development, which I'm a bit nervous about because I don't think that it's, first of all, possible to do any operation in the world without some bias, particularly an ethical bias. In other words, what you think is good and right and how the work that you do should be in service of that. And if what you think is good and right is prosperity alone, making money for yourself and your family, then that's going to play out in the sorts of investigations that you make about the universe. If you think it's good and right to be charitable, if you think it's good and right to have equal outcomes for all citizens, that's going to play out as well. And one person who is really famous for critiquing the
moral foundations.
Yeah, I was going to say the dichotomy between Western individualism and this Soviet collectivism.
I like that this whole trip has been basically about Soviet versus American tendencies.
Because you were talking about the space race last night.
Yeah, and before that, space communism.
But one person who's kind of famous, sort of really famous, I guess, one person who is quite famous for this analysis is Ayn Rand. And Ayn Rand has become something of a cartoon, I feel like, in intellectual circles because she's so over the top in her analysis of these phenomena. But she has some really good points, I think. And my own experience with Ayn Rand was that she helped me out of a lot of jams when I was younger, when I was learning how to be an adult for the first time, learning how to be an artist in the world.
Yeah, like we've talked about this a lot, where it's basically at some point, I think we both found ourselves surrounded by people that were kind of moral relativists, explored these ideas of collectivism a lot and had this vision of the massive promise of communism and what it could do for the world and lived according to those principles, but were maybe not actually very good people. And they tended to frown upon Ayn Rand. And I read Ayn Rand, I don't know, probably before college, and I really enjoyed the work. And then as I've gotten older and older, I've come across the fact that people are basically like not interested in her ideas at all. They're like very critical of her. And not in a way that seems very foundational. It just seems like she's become a caricature that's easily dismissed because of her, maybe because of her over-the-top criticisms.
Yeah. I mean, just to make it entirely personal, I went through all these phases when I was in my 20s, you know. I was in athletics early in college, and I was in this fraternity, and it was this very bro culture. And I turned away from that and ran into the arms of a bunch of hippies. And I became really disillusioned with that culture, too, because there was zero loyalty. There was zero reliability. The friendships seemed very hollow and thin. And there was a lot of pushback against the idea that as an artist, you should make a living at it, right? That you should actually be able to profit from your works as an artist was strongly frowned upon. Anything in that circle was, anything in that line of thinking was seen as inauthentic. And I was really troubled in my early 20s because I was like, damn, I want to do art for a living, or I want to do art all the time, but I also have to make a living. And so reading Ayn Rand really built this heroic model of what an artist could look like who was valued for their work. And so, you know, many, many years later, we're talking about the divorce of science and spirituality. And we're kind of circling back into this. We have a conversation planned about some of this Western esotericism with Michael Hughes, which we're going to get to soon.
Mm-hmm.
And the heart of that narrative seems to be the idea that science should be in line with some spiritual aim of the civilization, which seems very much at odds with the modern concept of science that we stated at the beginning of this conversation, which is to divorce oneself entirely from spirituality.
and to replace spirituality with what kind of amounts to being the cult of progress. Right, there's a movement called the Effective Accelerationists, whose idea is basically that the technology that we have developed has been the only thing that has prevented humans from the feared mass starvation and pestilence of Malthus and of the 1970s. And so the only possible option that we have right now is to press on the accelerator even faster and move deeper and deeper into this technological sphere, because technology is the only thing that has ever saved us. And that's kind of, it's interesting to think of science as being a vehicle for exploration that is directly tied into this permanent acceleration towards technological progress.
The disturbing thing about technological progress to me, and I think to Ayn, which will be evidenced in this essay that we're going to, or actually it's a speech we're going to read little parts of, is that there's no compass for that progress. And so what you have is people running full speed ahead. And we brought this up a couple of weeks ago with the Kurzweil conversation. You know, where is this headed toward? I don't know. We'll figure it out when we get there. And that's a really scary situation when you have a lot of power in a movement that has no orientation except for more, faster, stronger, etc.
And there's been a great difficulty in even really being able to figure out what a unified moral code would look like, right? Because I think that for good reason, people look at the institutional religions and they're like, yo, this has not panned out very well.
They're very quickly corrupted in terms of state power and so forth.
Institutions in general. Like, the minute that you start to get a strong institution, it starts to get other motivating aspects to it rather than just the pure ideals on which it was founded. And so it becomes corrupted and you have to start all over again. And so there just hasn't really been a good replacement for these institutional values. And people argue about this all the time, you know, utilitarianism, pragmatism, moral relativism. These are all attempts to look at the world and to say, okay, if we have these sets of rules, this way we can evaluate what is actually good in a way that falls outside of a religious framework. And the problem is that nobody's actually been able to figure out what that is. And so the scientists are like, okay, well, we don't really know what good is or what bad is, and that's not our job. You guys can figure that out. We can apply it later. Our job is to just figure this stuff out. And so we might as well just do our jobs, because that's what we're here for.
And what Ayn brings up, and I'll dig into this in just a second, is essentially that they, in doing your job, like, what is a job? It's something you get paid to do by somebody else. She's basically of the mindset that jobs are all bullshit, that the only real work is when you lead something forward, right? Which is sort of incompatible with the modern world. You could obviously have a job as a career scientist, but be a leader in that field if you wanted to, right? And so that would be a little bit more like, I think that would be more in line with what she sees as a producer. Like, she uses the word producer all the time for people who are actually doing stuff, right? Who are actually moving, thinking with their heads, not just showing up at the job, right? And so Ayn's central point here is that, hey, this is, by the way, this is in the nuclear era, right? People are terrified. The scientists are out of control. They're building these existential threat weapons. And all these kids at MIT just have their heads down in the books. And so she's reacting to that. So maybe I'm going to just read a couple. Well, I'm going to start and just read an excerpt from this. And feel free to cut me off if you have some thoughts. But I think this idea of the nuclear age, where the world is threatened by a new technology, is very much the spirit of what's happening today with the AI revolution. There's a lot of people worried about their jobs. I mean, if you want, you could make it about the climate revolution as well. But there's these scientific situations that have been sort of, they're where the money comes from. If you want to study something in science, you better peg it to AI or to climate somehow. Just like back in this day, if you wanted money, this is the point Ayn's making. If you want money, you got to build these weapons of mass destruction. That's where the money was in her day.
Or the better living through chemistry and the DuPonts of the world that are pumping out questionable chemicals and then dumping them in rivers and poisoning everybody without anyone really even realizing it.
Yeah, I think she's more concerned with the state-funded science, but you're right, you could equally apply it to just mindless job of doing blank, mindless task for chemical company X.
I mean, I think that those people, the companies get kickbacks and subsidies, and it's in the interest of the government to have these companies developing these technologies. And so it's hard for me to really differentiate, you know, going to work for Facebook to drive more addictive algorithms that swallow people versus going and working in a laboratory that's developing some kind of new chemical that's going to cause like 12 different types of cancer 50 years from now.
Exactly. So this speech that she gives is given to a bunch of MIT undergraduates who are presumably scientists, the next generation of scientists and engineers. And she's sort of like, hey, open your eyes and make deliberate ethical choices as you move forward, because nobody's going to make them for you. This machine is out of control and it's going to just keep paying you to do its bidding. And so, all right, let's hear her out for a second. Mm. Starts out, I'm going to skip the initial address. There's nothing much there. It took centuries and volumes of writing to bring our culture to its present state of bankruptcy. And volumes would have to be written to expose, counteract, and avert the disaster of a total intellectual collapse. But of all the deadly theories by means of which you are now being destroyed, I would like to warn you about one of the deadliest and most crucial: the alleged dichotomy of science and ethics.
Mm.
Okay, so right away she's making the point that taking the heart out of the scientists and having them be led on a leash by this mindless machine is at the top of her concerns with regard to the intellectual state of the world at the moment.
And what's really interesting is that these days there is the nod towards ethics. Every single scientist takes an ethics class.
You gotta take like some perfunctory
online
course.
And you go through and you're like, the Nazis experimented on people and that was bad. And so now we have IRBs and we don't do that kind of thing. But it's not really a deep and cutting edge exploration that challenges the foundations of the system. Because I think that
it's too exotic, right? It's we don't have Nazis. Oh yeah, if I see Nazis, I'll be sure to stop them in the future. But it doesn't really get to the heart of what does it mean to get paid to do a job?
That is a really fascinating and interesting question that I think that you're right that it doesn't get at the heart of. But I think that it also doesn't get to the heart of the questionable edifice of enormous research projects that are just plowing through farms of mice, doing crazy experiments on primates in order to get questionable benefit. Like, I think
100%.
About like a lot of the cancer research. Like, you can look at something like Neuralink and say, okay, yes, you have to do primate research in order to be able to get a device that doesn't kill the person that you implant it into, because you wouldn't ever be able to develop the device because you wouldn't have enough volunteers to take it while it's still experimental, right? And so there are some things that, because the demonstration of Neuralink is incredible. It's this guy who's totally paralyzed and now he can do stuff with his mind. And that's wild. That's a technological improvement where it's the ethics of animal research start to get cloudier and cloudier because it seems to have direct actionable benefit. But the hundreds of thousands of mice that get killed for a cancer drug that's not going to work?
I mean, I remember getting these reviews back on the papers we were submitting when I worked in cancer research, where the reviewers are literally saying, the statistical significance of this animal study would be improved by adding 200 more mice to it.
And that's absolutely true. And the question is then, what is the final efficacy of the drug when it's in humans, and what's the likelihood of there being efficacy? And
well,
how
honest are
you?
You have to couple that to that, right? Which is abysmal, right?
Especially because for glioblastoma, there's not a whole lot of things that work.
I haven't checked this stat in a long time, but a very, very large supermajority of preclinical animal trials fail to replicate in humans.
But basically, there is a difficulty for scientists, despite the lip service that's paid to taking an ethics class, to really sit down and to really gnaw on this idea of how does the entire structure fit together? What are the parts that we have to throw out? What are the parts that have been working for us? And I think that this is what she's pointing to in the 60s that we haven't resolved to this day, because the structures have just gotten bigger and stronger and more robust rather than more fragile.
Yeah, what am I doing this for? You know, this is the hardest thing to figure out as an artist too. Just, I think this could all apply to being an artist as well. It's like, yeah, you can sell out and make jingles for Coca-Cola for sure. But like, is that, what's that doing? You know, you only live for a short amount of time. I think she's really trying to get people to think about the fact that, hey, I have a lot of motive force in my being. I can do a lot in the world, and I can tread water, or I can move things in a direction that's going to be better for this entire human project.
Yeah.
All right, so let me keep going here.
Mm-hmm.
Science, they tell you, is the province of reason. But ethics, they say, is the province of a higher power. Which man's impotent, fallible intellect must not be so presumptuous as to challenge. Going on. Before you accept that doctrine, identify concretely and specifically what it means. Parentheses. Remember that ethics is a code of values to guide man's choices and actions, the choices and actions that determine the purpose and course of his life. End parentheses. It means that you, as scientists, are competent to discover new knowledge, but not competent to judge for what purpose that knowledge is to be used. You are to create the means, but they are to choose the ends. Your mind is to be the tool and servant of their whims. You are to create the H-bomb, but a blustering anthropoid will decide when he feels like dropping it and on whom.
Which is the status quo, and understandably so, because people have different life paths. Like, I don't know that we could live in a society that was governed by scientists all the way up and down. I don't know that that would necessarily be a better society. And so this is, so many of these criticisms that I run across feel like they're criticisms of society in general, which is that you have specialization, you have career paths, you have somebody that does one thing and another person who does another thing. And the reason that you can live a comfortable life is because you don't have to be responsible for absolutely everything at all times. And you don't have to be perfectly competent for deciding whether or not dropping some weapon of mass destruction on a population that's a threat to you is the right thing to do, because who are you to make that decision? Who is anyone to make that decision?
Yeah, I want to definitely unpack her solution set, which she ends the essay with. And to preview that, it's something along the lines of, you shouldn't accept a government that works against your human interests. But the implementation of that is obviously a real nightmare. So let's play with that after we make it through the speech. Should I keep going?
Yeah.
From Plato's Republic onward, all statist collectivists have looked longingly at an anthill as a social ideal to be reached. An anthill is a society of interdependent insects where each particular kind or class is physiologically able to perform only one specific function. Some are milch cows, some are toilers, a few are rulers. Collectivist planners have dreamed for a long time of creating an ideal society by means of eugenics, by breeding men into various castes physiologically able to perform only one specific function. Your place in such a society would be that of toiling milch brains, she's talking about the scientists, of human computers who would produce anything on demand and would be biologically incapable of questioning the orders from the anthropoid who'd throw them their food rations. Now, it's worth pointing out that Ayn escaped the Soviet Union not too long after the revolution. I don't recall the details of how she did that. And she has a really beautiful novel that has nothing really to do with her philosophy. Her first novel, I believe, was called We the Living, which is this love story about these two Soviets trying to escape the Soviet Union. And so, of course, Ayn's been traumatized by what she saw happen after the revolution. And so a lot of this is very, what would you say, melodramatic, right?
Reactive.
Reactive. She's very afraid of these collectivist planners, right?
But again, I think that this is a side effect of social organization, right? You look at the way that the first empires were built, and the first empires were not built on the basis of everybody doing everything. It was built on the back of specialization. You were the builders, you were the farmers, you were the bakers, you were the priests, you were the entertainers. And so...
And yet, the dream of democracy, the dream of a functional democratic republic is that, yeah, there's going to be people who are doing more decision-making than others, but everybody at least gets to check them, right? And the different branches of the government should be able to check each other. And so through all these checks and balanced power, you don't have runaway effects like that. That's the dream anyways. Whereas the collectivist statists have this dream of, well, we'll take the smartest people, they'll scientifically decide who's good for what and where the resources should go. And this is, of course, reflected in the space program, right, where they were trying to run all of the spacecraft from Earth, as opposed to the Americans who had these really highly trained pilots operating all these switches for contingencies that might arise, right? It's the dream, anyways. I'm not sure that we haven't drifted much closer to the Soviet way of life today than in the past.
I just wonder if it's possible once you get past a certain size of society to enact that dream, because you inevitably come across the fact that there's just too many competing concerns for everybody to equitably get together and decide. Like, we encountered this when we were interviewing all those worker-owned businesses. There was a real difficulty of decision-making and being able to move forward, because in a lot of them, they had unanimous decision or basically all but one decision-making, where everybody had to agree. The most dissenting voices you could have, I think, was one dissenting voice.
And I remember particularly at the taxi cab company in Madison, they would talk about these meetings that would go on for hours and hours, right?
And so it's like, you basically give away your ability to make these decisions because you recognize that, like, look, I don't have time for this. I can't do this. I have other things in my life. I can't go to an 8-hour meeting once a week in order to get through this. Just figure it out. I trust you. I believe in you. I've elected you. This is what a representative government is, right? You are people that we entrust with being able to choose this, and we want to be able to live our lives within the confines of what it is that you have decided that we should do. And so I feel like societies as a whole, once they're past this massive lawless expansionist phase, inevitably coalesce around this centralized planning narrative. And that's what the technological companies seem to be really pushing for right now, which is that we're going to invent an intelligence that is far beyond that of human intelligence, that can finally take the burden off of us, and we'll just operate in the background.
I want to add two little things. One is that there are actual alternatives to the representative democracy that we have. There's better ways of voting. There's ranked choice voting. What's that other really good one called? Oh, geez, I can't remember. There's a number of alternatives, right, where you essentially end up with your second or third place finding some representation, right? Right now, it's like if a particular presidential candidate loses, every single idea that he had gets lost. She gets lost completely. Whereas it'd be really interesting if the runner-up became the vice president, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. That's a much more effective way of representing the population, actually. So there's different ways of doing that. The second thing I would say is that the solution is, you know, and I don't think that Ayn gets at this entirely in the essay, even as we wrap it up, that you do have the choice of how you spend your time.
Mm.
As a scientist, you do have the choice of what you study. It might be a harder road, right? There's a road paved for you, and then there's the road unpaved.
Sure.
And, so she continues, Does your self-esteem accept such a prospect?
A prospect of?
Just that last...
Of being ruled by these anthropoid insect colonist sort of perspectives.
Who throw you your food rations.
Mm.
You know, she's like, is this even dignified?
Mm.
She goes, I'm going to skip some of this, but she goes on to say that she doesn't expect that dream is going to be achieved physiologically, but intellectually, there's another road.
We've talked about this before, too, in the sense that there are different spirits inside of humans, and there are the spirits that are pushing towards more of an individualistic lifestyle, and there is the spirit that pushes more towards the collectivist lifestyle. And it seems like we all have within us the ability to embody different versions of that and align with those who share the version that we seem to embody. And so humans contain all of these different spirits and we play them out. And depending on who's got control of the resources or control of the power, or control of people's hearts and minds, will kind of decide how the bulk of people move.
She says, you have not found it, not because it doesn't exist, but because it cannot be found without the help of a clean, intelligible, rational philosophy.
You have not found it being, sorry.
She's trying to say that that dream is never, that dream of shrugging off these anthropoids, right? Which she calls her philosophy objectivism, of course. She says, part of this philosophy, this intelligible, rational philosophy, is ethics. It cannot be found until you realize that man cannot exist as a half-scientist, half-brute, that all the aspects of his existence can be and should be the subject to the study and the judgment of his intellect, and that all human disciplines, of all human disciplines, it is ethics, the discipline which sets his goals that should be elevated into a science. I would say that it should be integrated into a scientific life.
I don't know that you can boil ethics down to a science. Like, I think that this is what we started with, which is this idea of spirituality and this idea of figuring out what is good. Because what is science if not... I know that you don't really like the idea of science being involved in with experimentation, but it is about storytelling at the very least. And so it's like...
It's about logical storytelling, right?
But I think that ethics is about emotional storytelling. Logic is actually the domain where you... I mean, Star Trek deals with this really deeply, right? Because you have the Vulcans, who are these deeply rational creatures. And then in Next Generation, you have Data, who's basically an android that doesn't have an emotional chip. And so you have these creatures that are able to reason perfectly, but they're not able to actually build a society that is human. And so I don't think...
Humane,
yeah. I mean, and they're not cruel, right? Like, they don't have a streak of cruelty and vindictiveness in them. They're just cold and unemotional. And I think that there is great evidence to suggest that that's not a particularly humane way of organizing a society. And so if you put ethics into the domain of science, do you really get something good out of that? Isn't it just going to be more of this objectivist or faux objective perspective where it's like we're just this eyeball without any beliefs or preferences that are evaluating the way that the world should work, as opposed to being like, hey, ethics is about moral feeling. It's about emotion.
Well, she defines it as being the discipline which sets your goals. It's how you orient yourself towards a future. It's like, what future do you want and how do you get to it?
Sure, but I don't think that that's a scientific question. I think that that's an emotional question.
I think it's certainly an existential question. It's certainly a values question, right?
But aren't values emotional?
I don't know.
Interesting.
I guess so. I mean, most people would say that they feel their values, but she's saying that you can actually deduce your values, right? This is where people start to lose touch with Ayn Rand in general, right? Because she leans into this calculating side of being a human being that seems to miss some of the more raw, intuitive sides of our existence, which actually can be pretty good guides for how to behave. She says, no man and no class of men can live without a code of ethics, But if there are degrees of urgency, I would say that it is you, the scientists, who need it most urgently. The nature of your power and of your responsibility is too obvious to need restatement. You can read it in every newspaper headline. It's obvious why you should know, before you start out, to what purpose and service you choose to devote the power of your mind. And, good God, like, it might seem pretty naive and obvious to most people, but that's what I needed to hear when I was a teenager, when I was contemplating what I was going to do with my particular interests, right? I like playing music. I like drawing. I like theater. I like science. I like knowing how the world works. But what do I do with it, right?
And this is a really common feature for people, right? They look out onto the world and they're like, well, I like being comfortable. And so maybe what I'll do is I'll just make a bunch of money and therefore I'll be secure and stable and that's going to be what a good life looks like. And that, I think, a really grand appreciation for comfort makes it possible to do ethically and morally questionable things because you can justify it to yourself as being, you know, a necessary evil of the fact that you live this really comfortable and secure life and you're set for retirement and you don't run the risk of homelessness and you're basically just living the way that you're entitled to live. And it's a really tricky moment because I think that a lot of people are on the edge, right? If you go and you do something that is risky, you live in a society that will not protect you from the consequences of taking that risk. You can end up homeless. You can end up destitute. You can end up being old and having to work as a Walmart checkout person. Like, these are very, very real consequences of not making sure that you're set up for winter. And I don't think that this is a new problem, because if you look at, like, Aesop's Fables, you know, the fable of the grasshopper and the ant?
No, sure, please.
It's that the ant spends all summer working, and the grasshopper spends all summer singing. And the ant is like, yo, dude, don't you think that you should get a little bit of work done? And the grasshopper's like, no, man, it's fantastic outside. Like, we got a party. And then the winter comes and the grasshopper dies, but the ant survives because the ant has spent all summer preparing for the coming winter. And so if that's in Aesop's Fables, that's a thing that's been with us for forever. So it's not like you can totally disentangle yourself from that, because we talk about the consequences of nature being very, very real all the time. And the consequences of not getting prepared for winter, metaphorically and literally, are fatal. And each life has a summer and winter in it on the, you know, the kind of metaphysical scale, where there's a moment where you can prepare yourself for the time that you will be weakened.
And I think that the optimistic lining of Ayn Rand's objectivism is that the hero of her story, you know, the Fountainhead, for instance, is able to eventually overcome this starving artist lifestyle because he sticks to his guns. He knows what's beautiful and right, right? I mean, he's an architect. He wants to design buildings that are harmonized with the earth and so forth, right? And this is very unpopular in the brutalist architecture of his day. And it's hell for him his entire career. But eventually, it works out, right? And that's the promise. It's like, eventually, it works out.
And that's a really tricky thing, right? Because we were talking about this yesterday, where it's like, there's no guarantee that it's going to work out. And even if you come up with something that's fantastic, like we were talking about Van Gogh. Van Gogh dedicates his entire life to making these stunning paintings. Nobody cares. He's completely destitute, living his life, completely thinking that nobody cares and nobody ever will care except for his brother who's trying to show his paintings and nobody's interested. And that's just the life that he leads, and it's tragic. And I think that a lot of people don't want to lead that
life. And you meet a lot of, like, aside from the famous people, you know, Nick Drake, Van Gogh, you meet these people all the time when you're an artist, right?
Yeah. They're just kind of knocking around, and it's hard, and it's not working out, and nothing's catching. And there's a time where you start to get really afraid for good reason. And so when that fear strikes, I think it's really easy for people to start making moral compromises, because what is more compromising than fear and worry and anxiety?
And the optimistic objectivist would maybe quote Tom Petty and say, most of the things most of the things I worry about never happen anyways. Which is so funny, because it seems to be the truth in my own life.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And yet, I also recognize that I'm like, we are in a precarious place. Like you and I.
Existences too. This is what I always find myself coming back to. I'm like, just, you know, even if you do everything right, make millions of dollars, nobody can buy you their way out of death, out of disease, out of losing the people they love. It's coming for all of us. And I feel acutely aware of that on the day to day, where I'm like, yeah, maybe I'm worried about not having enough money for next year, but I'm also going to be dead in like a few years. So, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's fatalistic and dark, but it's, I think that it's necessary in order to undertake any endeavor that's risky. And so as you go out into the world, I think that the idea that I really appreciate from this essay is that, look, there are things that are comfortable, and the things that are comfortable are tempting because you abdicate responsibility and you do not have the burden of trying to figure out what is good and right in the world. You simply take on to yourself the burden of accepting the good and right that comes from somebody else. And that's really, it's so easy. It's so satisfying. You know, when you...
If you think about the people that retreat to science too, right? They tend to be a little bit on the nerdy side, right? A little bit conflict averse. Kind of want to just be left alone to study nature. And it's totally understandable, right? I totally get the idea of wanting to just be locked in a studio or a laboratory and just left alone. But the reality is that the world is turning, and that somebody's paying your rent in that studio. Somebody's paying that rent in that laboratory.
And I think that what's really crazy about this is that if you don't do it, somebody else will, and they will benefit. And so I think that it's really easy to make the decision of like, okay, well, if I don't do it, that guy will. And they're going to get all the benefit of it. And I'm just going to live this really kind of painful life. And so why not just do the thing that's easy and comfortable?
Yeah.
So, because it's not like my objection will stop it. You hear this all the time when we talk to people about political movements or boycotts or any of the actions that we would have to take as a whole in order to stop, say, the financialization of the economy, right? Everybody would have to divest from the, I don't know, BlackRock or something, or Vanguard, in order to prevent these massive financial entities from having huge influence.
Retirements are tied up in it, right? People who have no financial wherewithal. I hardly have any financial wherewithal, right?
And that's what I'm saying. Like, no one can, the idea that prevents people from divesting from these systems is like, well, everybody's invested in them. And if I don't invest in them,
inflation's going to kill my savings.
Yeah. And so you have these situations where it's, the system is so locked in and so effective. The machine is just grinding away. And you're like, I would be stupid not to participate in the machine.
Right. So I still think that the only thing you have a choice over is how you spend. I mean, the easiest thing you have a choice over is how you spend your time.
Yeah.
It might be difficult and it might not be financially rewarding, but you do have that choice. I want to get through a couple more passages here. Just to reiterate this paradigm. Quote, if a professional soldier were to accept a job with Murder, Inc. and claim that he is merely practicing his trade, that it is not his responsibility to know who is using his services or for what purposes, he would be greeted by a storm of indignation and regarded as a moral psychopath. Yet, at his bloodiest worst, he could not perpetrate a fraction of the horrors achieved by any haughty ascetic of science who merely places a slip of paper with some mathematical computations into the hands of Khrushchev or Mao or any of the imitators in America, and having read no newspapers since 1914, declares himself to be, quote, above the battle. So ignorance is not an excuse. If you are now starting on a career in science, you do not have to share the guilt of those men, but you do have to reclaim the field and the honor of science. There is only one way to do it, by accepting the moral principle that one does not surrender one's mind into blind servitude of thugs, and one does not accept the job of munitions maker for Attila's conquest of the world, not for any Attila, actual or potential, foreign or domestic. There is only one way to implement that principle. Throughout history, with only a few exceptions, governments have claimed the right, quote, to rule men by any means of physical force, that is, by terror and destruction. When the potential of terror and destruction reaches today's scale, it should convince every human being that if mankind is to survive, Attila's concept of the government must be discarded, along with the alleged right to any man to impose their ideas or wishes on others by initiating the use of physical force. This means that men must establish a free, non-coercive society, where the government is only a policeman protecting individual rights, where force is used only in retaliation and self-defense, where no gang can seize legalized power to unleash a reign of terror. And that's, I think, where I want to end that essay, because she goes on and says a few things with respect to the present situation at the time in the 60s with regard to the nuclear disaster. Well, the nuclear armament and disarmament disaster, and she has particular solutions and ideas about that. But I think that it really gets at the heart of her solution set, which is that you should get a hold of your government, which is a weird way to end the essay, I think, because I think the more salient point here is that you have a right to your own mind and how you use the power of your being throughout your lifetime in service of the science. She's addressing scientists, so what you do with your science, which kind of gets buried at the end in favor of these more specific examples about harnessing, you know, getting in control of your government and so forth, which is just a very, very difficult thing to get behind in this day and age, because you get two choices and they both suck. And so, you know, when I think about really not feeling hopeless about the future of the country and the future of the world, it really comes down to how I spend my time on a daily basis and the interactions I have with real people in those workings.
We were talking about this yesterday too, where there's been a really big shift in the way that people choose to spend their time, right? If you go back 50 years or so, let's say 70 years, like we were talking to your parents about this. And so if you are young in the 1950s and you're looking out onto the future, there's a sense of really significant optimism about the institutions that are available to you. It is just after the war, you are in the moral upstanding position where you have defended yourself against the Soviet onslaught, you have stopped the Nazis, you have done true good in the world, and all of the institutions that are part of the fabric of American life are the institutions that you should participate in because they have proved themselves in this massive conflict to be upstanding. Now, that is a really narrow window in American life of optimism, because after that, you start to get the 60s, which is this idea that, hey, the really deeply constrained institutional life of the 1950s isn't good. It's really heartless. You have women's rights. You have civil rights that are starting to percolate up, where people are realizing that, hey, hold on a second. We did good during World War II, but let's look upon ourselves now. You know, like you should see the mote in your own eye before noticing the mote in someone else's eye. You should notice the beam in yours.
I think it's before I tried to talk into the coffee cup.
Like, we should put little microphones in the coffee cups.
Before noticing the mote in someone else's, you notice the like pebble in your own
eye. Beam.
The beam, that's it.
The beam in yours, yeah. Exactly. And so I think that the 1960s was this moment where people were like, well, hey, hold on a second. Perhaps we can restructure this society into something that is genuinely equal. And so, like, this is why I think that there's a lot of participation of, Jewish Americans in the civil rights movement. This is a characteristic of it, that you had all of these liberal Jews.
Freedom riders
that were like, hey, hold on a second. Like, this is what we fought for in Europe, and now we have to do it here. And their parents are, like, trying to distance themselves from it because they don't really want to rock the boat. And so now you have this next social movement. And as we come out of that era of institutional turmoil, you go into an era of just consumerist prosperity, where all of those leaders that were trying to challenge the status quo are exterminated. All of the institutions that appeared to be poised to revolutionize American life, like down to the unions, are gradually, I don't want to say they become toothless, but they become corrupted and working for themselves rather than for the ideological goals that they had at some point. And so now you have a generation of people that have been raised in the 80s and 90s, and they're looking at the world and they're realizing that the world is not really built for them. You know, you can't buy a house. You can't hold down a job for a really long time. The jobs that are available to you are morally questionable. And so now you have to come up with a new value system. And I've been noticing this as we travel, where it seems like there is a sense of decay that comes from that, because the more people that you have traveling and distancing themselves from institutions, the harder it becomes to actually build something that's functional, because you have to stay in one place and you have to have obligations and you have to have skin in the game in order to build something. And so,
what have you specifically seen? What are the sites you've seen that reflect this?
I think the van lifers, like people that are, instead of buying a house where they would pay property taxes and having kids that they send to school, and so they have this generational integration into the landscape that forces them to really get involved, to get involved with local government, to get involved with the PTA, to really start affecting their municipalities. Instead, they buy a van that's $150,000, and they're perpetual digital nomads living in all these places, using services that are provided by the people that are locked in place, right? Like, you go to a restaurant while you're traveling, that restaurant is run by somebody that is locked in. And so there's a weird flow of people across the landscape that are taking from it, but they're not contributing to it in a real productive way, because they're working for somebody elsewhere. And so it's this really interesting new movement of people that are even more atomized and even more isolated. And like we talk about this in context of academic research all the time, or not research, academic teaching. Like, you used to have an institution where there were tenured professors, and those professors would have a lot of say on how the department went and what it would teach and how that would look. And now you have an ocean of adjuncts, and those adjuncts are perpetually moving around, and they don't have any say in the department that they're a part of. And so now you just have this bureaucracy that's kind of just telling you what's going to happen. Same thing in the healthcare system.
And the bureaucracy just turns it into a resort that makes money, essentially.
The planned community environment of the universities is like a topic unto itself, yeah.
I just see more and more and more positions being hired that are concerned with the comfort. It really sounds like hotelier agenda, right? It's like, how do we make everybody comfortable and happy? Not like, how do we prepare them for existence? Right? That's never, ever a concern. That has never once come up in any of these emails that I get constantly about the discussions about the future of the place.
The place being the
university that I work at, which I'm probably going to get fired for now if anybody finds this podcast. I love you guys. Don't hurt me. Or fire me. That's fine, I guess. But
I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that it seems like we are going through this ebb in the trust and faith in institutions, and everybody's in motion, from the healthcare industry to the academies to the tech workers. No one's loyal to anyone. Everybody's just this free agent that has to make their own life and figure out how it is that they're going to survive for 80-odd years without getting poisoned by whatever's in the food supply, and without having to sacrifice too much of their time and energy for something.
Not having your savings evaporate to inflation, these things that are just background dangers.
And so I think that the only thing that you can really do in that kind of circumstance is figure out what is the minimum unit of survival that you need, right? Like, there's been this really interesting discussion that I've noticed happening on Twitter recently, where people are like, look, most of the stuff that you get from modernity isn't really that good for you. Like, healthcare is good, dental care is good, you know, the ability to contact people at a distance is really good, access to information is good.
Avoiding healthcare and dentists is also good, right? Which can be accomplished.
If you're able to disentangle yourself from all of the things that modernity offers you, right? Like, this is the heart of Ayn Rand's point. She's like, look, you have an ability to do something in the world. You are smart, you are driven, you are motivated, and there will be a massive pressure on you to put that talent to work for a machine that isn't good for you in the long run, certainly isn't good for your children, and isn't good for your neighbors. And the only way that you can avoid participating in that is by looking around and being like, what is the minimum that I need? And I've really, really lived my life that way since I was a teenager. Like, you know, any time that I would make any money at a job, I would always squirrel away at least a third of it. Like, every paycheck, I would put a third of it away into an account where I'm like, look, this is the grounds that will allow me to make choices later. And that meant that in the moment, you know, I had to live really slim and, like, not eat out, not buy a bunch of stuff, not live this profligate life where I just kind of spent the money because it felt like that's what I should do because I made it. And I think that that's been the driving organizing principle for me, where I'm like, look, comfort is really tempting and I have to fight against it, because if I lean into comfort too much, I get locked into a position that I don't want to be in. And what I want more than anything in my life is self-determination, is the ability to say, I'm going to do this and I'm free to do this and I have the means to do this because I have avoided the tentacles that pull me into some kind of system that I don't believe in.
And that is what America should be about. Really, really, that's the spirit in the most beautiful sense of what it means to be in the forefront of some actually humane Western civilization.
But the problem is that America is also about selling, and it's also about consumerism, and it's also about the cult of the self and PR. And
I believe it's grown this way for sure over the course, you know, of its history. But when I'm just thinking of idealism, you know, what does that ideal future look like? And it is a world in which people are self-determined and they do follow their reason and their intuitions to a more effective future, a more humane future, a better world that we want to live in.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you have a lot of discipline there. I totally have sympathy for people who, you know, some of my friends who are the deepest into the machine, they spend a lot of money on toys and stuff, right? Because you spend all this time in an office, and it's kind of a drag, and you want a little dopamine after that, right?
Yeah.
And that's understandable.
And I think that there is a way out. There's a way to be able to make the ethical choice that you determine for yourself to be ethical, right? You have to look out onto the world and you have to see what is good and right. And these are things that I feel on a really achingly deep level, where I look out onto the world and I'm like, I don't want to participate in that. And I'm like, I understand that other people will participate in it and I have no influence over them, but my ability to determine the way that my life will look is far more important to me than, you know, buying a new pair of shoes or something.
And it's something you have absolute power over. As far as things that you have control over in the world, you really do have control over how you spend your time, how you behave when you interact with people. And it's scary when you first wake up to that, because you can become extremely self-conscious and freaked out in social interactions, and you can get almost gridlocked, like, oh my God, what do I do with my day? It's so important. But there's a lot of power there. There's a lot of empowerment there.
And I just think that the thing that has ideologically captured this place is eternal consumerism. It is convenience. Like, and I know that this sounds really Soviet, but I've started to realize that anything that you can buy that that is somebody selling you convenience is probably not that good for you. And it's usually more expensive. It's more expensive than the thing that's inconvenient.
Give me an example.
Like buying a frozen dinner instead of making your own dinner.
Or just going out to dinner.
Or just going out to dinner. Like, I'm like, yes, it is convenient to go out to dinner. It's convenient to buy the prepared food. But I think that there is a muscle that you build in saying, you know what? No, I will not do what is convenient. I will do what is good.
I was really inspired when we went to the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum the other day. We're in Santa Fe, by the way. That at the end of the exhibit, there's a picture of Georgia cooking her dinner and a bunch of her artifacts from her kitchen and so forth. And it was just, I thought it was super badass that here's a woman who, I think she had $65 million in her estate in 1980s money, which is almost three times that now. And she's just sitting there cooking dinner for herself, you know? It's like, I thought that was super badass.
I mean, these are the things. And it's like, if you are working a job where at the end of the day you come home and you're just so drained that you can't even imagine cooking dinner for yourself, which is the most basic act of self-love that you can make, then maybe that's a sign of like, hey, your life doesn't look the way that you want it to look. Because the idea of, think of an animal that's like, I'm too tired to feed myself. That animal dies. That animal dies. And so I know this is like a totally insane perspective that most people don't have. And so I feel like a little bit naked sharing it. But I really do think that these are all gut feelings that you have to accumulate about your life. And when you start to feel them, instead of dissociating from them and being like, no, it's okay. This is just how it has to be. This is just what my life looks like. Like, really figure out how to cut down to the basics to be able to say, okay, now I have a little bit of leverage, and that leverage will allow me to do something else. Because otherwise, the machine will eat you. And I don't want anybody to be eaten by the machine. Like, that's not good for me. It's not good for you. It's not good for anybody. Like, the machine operates on the grinding will of all of the people that move in it. It's like if everybody got off the treadmill, the hedonic treadmill, the comfort treadmill, the whatever treadmill, I think that we would be able to make really serious changes that would make the future less frightening.
And right, and it's about incremental changes, right? This isn't about, hey, go quit your job today. It's not what I'm saying at all, right? It's like,
I'm not even saying quit your job.
Right. That's not what I'm saying at all either. I'm just saying that you can perhaps move yourself in a direction. You can make a plan for this next gig that I take. Is that going to move me towards my ideal vision of what I should be doing in service of my talent, like in service of the world that I live in, using my talents, right?
Yeah.
And not just talents being shorthand for your skill set or that your interests and so forth.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's about these baby steps. It's about stepwise motion towards that beautiful ideal. It's not about really just revolutionarily breaking free and doing it.
I think that there's also an aspect of developing will and discipline too, which is why I'm really big on meditation. And I know that it's not everybody's bag where it's, you know, you have to sit and just train your focus and your concentration. But I've been reading this really interesting book called The Mind Illuminated, which is just this really straightforward stepwise progression of the goal of meditation. And it lays it out really well, where it's like, the idea is that you are able to govern the thing that you choose to focus on. And a lot of us, I think myself included, are often waylaid by these other systems that force our concentration onto something that we don't want to be focused on. Like, this is what worry and fear is, right? Like you said earlier, Tom Petty's quote, most of the things I worry about never happen. And it's like, yeah, exactly. And so if you had the wherewithal to focus your concern just onto the things that you want to be focused on, then you would be able to operate in a more fluid and just less torqued up way. And then you'd be able to make decisions that weren't based on fear and worry, but instead were based on the actual grounds of what those decisions do to you. And so meditation is the process of learning how to disconnect from the emotions that aren't
serving. Clear the clutter off the table and actually see your choices clearly.
That, yeah, and to be able to withstand the pull of something. Like, you talk a lot about the idea that emotions are us being possessed by gods. You become possessed.
In like the pagan Greek,
yeah,
Sumerian
yeah, yeah,
sense,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Like being possessed by the god of rage.
Sense.
Yeah, being possessed by the god of rage, by the god of indulgence, by the god of
lust.
Yeah. And so there are some gods that you want to be possessed by. And I think that that's.
It's about making that choice of when to let them in, though, right?
That's exactly
the
right.
Governor.
That's exactly
the strength
right.
of the governor, which is really discipline.
And so I'm like, I feel like in our world right now, when we talk about discipline, it is almost immediately like Nazi adjacent, which is like a really weird development that's happened over the course of the last few years.
How do you see that? Where do you see that?
I've seen it in these occasional PowerPoints from DEI organizations that are like being on time and being really disciplined. These are white supremacist values.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that don't belong to these other cultures.
Mm.
And so expecting that people will perform to these standards is racist. Like this is like an undercurrent of a lot of the DEI stuff. And there's been a big reaction against them for good reason. But I do think that it's a little alarming to come out and so clearly say it, because there's lots of people who would be like, oh, well, that's just, you know, that's ableist and that's racist and whatever else. But I'm like, look, each of us has within us this untrained, undisciplined, emotional shadow. And the only thing that will allow us to make changes in our lives is if we look at that shadow and we see it for what it is and we learn to manage it. And that's
why we have to learn to be forgiving of it too.
Yeah.
You know, no, even when you see this and know this, there's times that those lesser gods get a hold of you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it really sucks and it's really embarrassing and it's horrible when it happens. But you have to learn to forgive yourself and recognize that you can do better. And that's, I think, if you don't integrate that spirit of forgiveness into this project, you can end up in a really terrifying pinch that sort of gives off the vibes of the puritanical forefathers of this country,
mm-hmm.
right? Where if you screw up, you're doomed. And
you're like marked for life.
Yeah. And you can feel that in your own daily life too. It's so easy to just make these tiny little missteps in your daily life. You know, you're in a hurry and you don't let someone through a door, and you probably should have, right? Or whatever. You just have a sort of grumpy tone when you're interacting with your spouse or whatever. It's easy to screw up and then to start kicking yourself and feeling horrible and feel like the whole project is pointless because you're never going to be perfect. But I think that discipline requires the spirit of forgiveness in order to actually make it a functional philosophy.
There's a really interesting aspect.
Or maybe you don't eat the right food one night, or you don't manage to take the cold shower one morning, or you don't do the workout. It's like, that's going to happen. It's okay. It's not what you should aim for, but you need to stop, reorient yourself, and move on.
There's a really interesting aspect of meditation practice, which is that the goal is not to punish yourself when you stop focusing on the breath, but instead to appreciate the fact that you have noticed that you have stopped doing the right thing and to redirect yourself and to continue.
I like that a lot.
And I'm like, yeah.
You could do it with this, back to the essay, you could do it with your own pursuits in your career, right?
Yeah, like if you wake up all one morning and you're like, God, this isn't what I want to be doing, just start working towards what it is. Figure out what you want. And that's, you and I, a couple years ago, did Jordan Peterson's self-authorship suite. It's probably like 6 or 7 years ago now. And I think that it was really, really illuminating as a process of figuring out what it is that we wanted out of our lives.
That's definitely the first step. Who do you want to be?
Who do you want to be? And then you can start figuring out, okay, how do I actually take steps that move me in that direction? And so, yeah, Ayn's right. To young scientists.
And it can be just so daunting to look at who you want to be versus who you are and just be like, well, geez. And, you know, just get the whiskey out or something, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I totally understand that. But when you realize that it's not about making it happen tomorrow, it's about maybe making it happen 10 years from now, 20 years from now. And it's not really about the time frame. It's that once you start moving in that direction, everything changes for you. You're all of a sudden headed somewhere. And that can get you through any number of pains.
Yeah, definitely. And it's easy to be waylaid along the path, but as long as you stop and see that there is a path that you want for yourself, then it's just the process of noticing when you've lost the path. It's like, that's what it's like when you're hiking. You're on a path, and sometimes the path diverges, and you go down the wrong one, and after, you know, half a mile or something, it disappears, and you're like, ah, no, that was the wrong turn. And then you have to go back and you have to find it again. And it's this perpetual search for something that makes sense, something that is aligned with the things that you want to be doing, and a constant redirection.
Aligned with the future that you want to see happen, right?
Yeah, because otherwise it's just going to devour you. Like, the world will devour you if you're not careful. And before you know it, you're going to be 50 years old and not be the person that you wanted to be and have not even started on the path. And that's a pretty scary, for me, that's really scary, because I think about what my deathbed is going to look like all the time. And I really orient myself. It's like Grandmaster Flash has that hit detection thing.
Art detection.
I have death detection, where I'm like, what do I want my death to look like? And that's ominous, I think, for a lot of people. You never let me talk about death openly on the podcast. You always get squirrely about it. But I'm like, I have a vision for what I want to die as. And that is what has always oriented me. I'm like, what will my death look like? What will I have done? Who will I be?
What are people going to say? Yeah, it's a really interesting thought experiment.
I don't really think too much about what people... I try not to think about that.
Well, that's the same thing, right? It's like, who are you? Right? Because people are going to say who you are. You know, maybe in more or less polite ways, but that's what happens at every funeral I've been at.
Yeah, that's true. And so inevitably people will say things about you, but I'm sort of thinking about my own internal sense of knowing that the end is nigh, and like, what will my emotional state be when I have to confront the fact that it's over and there's no more chances? And that's like what really drives me, because I'm like, there will be a moment where there are no chances, no more, nothing is left. The only, and I feel like I got this off my mom. Like, my mom is really, she just has this really deep sense of life being an arc, and that as you go through the arc, there's the gradual narrowing of opportunities to fix things. If only because people die, right? Like, if you've wronged someone, and that person dies, and you never get the chance to fix it, is that something that you want to have with you when you're dying? You will be thinking about it, right? Because you had that crazy experience where you passed out, and you said that you had all of these like different scenes from your life that were playing out as if it was this like massive jumbotron that was just playing all of these things. You will think about that. And I'm like, I want to be able to think about that and have the moment of doing the right thing in the memory, because I don't want to die being like, God, I should have done that.
I don't want to live like that. I mean, it plagues me more in my waking life than, you know, in some final moments.
The death motivates me, because I'm like, if I don't fix it right now, I won't be able to fix it later.
And I have the sense that when I'm distracted by all of these negative thoughts and emotions and fears and worries, that I'm sort of dying. I literally feel like I'm dying. And I'm trying to find ways to keep the death out of my life as much as possible.
Interesting. God. So you have a negative emotion and it feels like you're dying?
When I'm plagued by thoughts, yeah, by these spiraling thoughts, you know, of things I could have done better or whatever. Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting.
Unless I move through them and recognize, okay, so I'm just reorienting myself, I'm getting back on the path, and we're good to go. And that's all it takes. But sometimes it can get a little dark. I mean, it's been harder when I was younger than it is these days. I didn't have this technology laid out for myself as well when I was younger.
I feel like I spend a lot of time trying to work out what is going wrong in the moment to prevent myself from going too far down that path. I think that the idea of death, like I, you know, if I have an argument with somebody, my within like a few minutes of the peak of the argument, I can be like, God, we're going to die soon and we need to fix this and we need to recover. And like whatever momentary high horse I've gotten on isn't worth it. And like, it's best to go and repair and like figure out how to move past it. And so I try to like really quickly, like I'm always, it's the meditation thing. Like as soon as you notice, just be like, okay, we got to go fix this. Like, we got to fix this.
Yeah, you have a particular talent for that, honestly, that you don't see too often in people. And it's, I'm very, very grateful for knowing somebody like you who has that talent, because I don't think I've ever really met anybody like that before.
Really?
Who's really committed to that transition.
Interesting. You gotta live and you gotta die good.
All right, folks, it's in your hands every minute, every day, especially as scientists. Who's paying for your science and what are they going to do with it?
Or what are they going to do with anything that you do? It doesn't have to be science.
Sure. Yeah.
It's like, what is the technology that you're building? What is the time that you're spending? I don't think you have to do anything spectacular with your life in order to make it a good life. I think that you just have to be doing something that feels meaningful. And whether or not that's working a job somewhere where you feel like it's, you're taking care of the place and you are making it better and you're building something you believe in, or it's you're living some van life existence and traveling around and doing something that makes the communities that you stop in better. Like, it doesn't matter. It has to be more than just the process of earning and consuming mindlessly. Like, make it matter and everything will be okay. And this is Jordan Peterson's thing. Start, clean up your room.
You know, Jordan got it from countless prophets before him. Yeah, it's not a new idea, but it is worth touching on, and particularly in the context of science, because this is not going away. The more conversations we have, the more that we discover a moral valence to the sciences that we're investigating, and it becomes increasingly clear that a lot of the scientists that we talk to are uncomfortable with that element because it's been bred out of them in institutional pipelines. And that's not good. So
for anybody,
we're not going to shut up about it. We're going to keep trying to understand what these ideas are in service of. And we hope all of you will too. So we'll see you next week. I guess we'll be back in California. And we're going to go up to Taos this weekend and play a little music festival. And we're stoked. We hope you guys have been enjoying this series. Little bit of solo conversations, which is wonderful because we hardly ever get to sit down and have an uninterrupted conversation. And maybe we'll keep doing them once we get back, depending on whether you guys enjoy this or not.
Bye, everybody.
See ya.